there. I'm Noelle King of NPR's Planet Money podcast. I'm sitting in for Joshua Johnson. Thanks for downloading the 1A podcast from WAMU and NPR for March 23rd, 2017. Thanks for listening to 1A. If you need something else to try, especially if you want a deep dive, we recommend NPR's Embedded podcast. It's hosted by Kelly McEvers, and right now they're looking at videos of police encounters, those grainy clips we see in the news all the time. This week's episode is about a surprising and harrowing confrontation between a police officer and a murder suspect in a small Ohio town. The episode looks into an officer's mind in the moments before shots are fired. Find Embedded now on the NPR One app or at npr.org/podcasts. Here is a recent headline from The Washington Post. Black teens are reported missing and far too few people notice. Earlier this month, there was a spate of reports here in D.C. of black teenagers who'd vanished. But the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and law enforcement agencies say the number of missing kids in D.C. is in line with the numbers in other American cities. They say what has changed is that there's now a more sustained effort to get the word out about teens who have gone missing. Joining me here in studio to talk about what's going on is Julia Craven of the Huffington Post. She's been covering the story. Julia, welcome to 1A. I appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start out with the big question here. What is going on in Washington, D.C. with these missing teenagers?
Well, right now, MPD is, they're publicizing when these girls go missing or when these teenagers go missing. It's both genders. And the number of missing person cases hasn't increased in the district. It's right along with what we see nationwide. Is actually down a little bit. And the real difference is that they're publicizing these cases. However, on the community side, they don't care about that. They're looking at it like, we didn't know that this was the number. And we don't care about the number. We care about the fact that there are teenagers who are going missing for a myriad of reasons, whether they're running away from something, whether they're running to something.
Okay, so the police are looking at numbers. The community is frantic anyway. Let me start with something that I'm very curious about. Why is the D.C. Police Department publicizing these cases all of a sudden?
Well, they got a new chief of their youth and division services. Her name is Chanel Dickerson, and she has pledged that she is going to make sure that every child who is critically missing gets some type of publicity, whether it be a Twitter, whether it be a Facebook, and if necessary, widespread media attention, like if there's a case of, like we saw with Relisha Rudd 3 years ago.
So this is obviously a good initiative, but it has had the unintended consequence of making people think, or apparently making people think, that many more kids are going missing than were before.
Right.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about something that really does seem to have the D.C. community concerned, which is a racial disparity in the number of children who are going missing. Can you talk to me a little bit about the numbers that are making people convinced that this is happening in some communities but not in others?
Yes. So MPD has not provided, or at least not to my knowledge, they haven't provided a racial breakdown of the teenagers who are going missing. However, if you keep seeing tweets about all of these missing black and brown girls, there's going to be a lot of cause for concern. And there are tensions between MPD and the black community here, specifically in Ward 8, that's southeast D.C.
And that's where a lot of these kids are going missing.
Right, that's where a lot of these kids are going missing from. So the community members are very concerned. They're rightfully concerned. And when you couple that with the tensions that already exist between the police and these communities, it's just like, okay, here's another issue where you're not looking out for us. And this is something that we care about. We care about our babies. Like, we want them to come home. If they're running away, why are they running away from home? Why do they have this history? Do we need better mental health services? Do we need to take this child out of this environment? Is this a good environment for this child? Or are they being lured by human traffickers off the internet? So it could be anything.
A lot of very, very scary thoughts for parents.
Right. And MPD does close 95% of missing persons cases. But still, like, people don't care about that. Like, they want the issue to stop.
I want to bring someone else into the conversation. We have on the line with us from Milwaukee, Robert Lowry Jr. He is vice president of the Missing Children Division of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. He also worked as an assistant police chief in the suburbs of St. Louis. Robert, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me on. And again, I apologize for being a little late coming in. I was having troubles with the phone here.
Not a problem at all, Bob. Let me ask you something. We've been talking locally about a perception in D.C. that more kids are going missing. Julie has been telling us a little bit about how it may just be more publicity. But when we look at the national picture, where does D.C. stack up in terms of the numbers of missing kids?
Well, you know, I do start off the conversation by saying that one child missing is too many. But I do agree. I did join in and I heard Julia's comments that the numbers are actually going slightly down. The D.C. numbers of missing children are fairly consistent with what we see in major cities around the country. It's typically going to be especially runaway children, which attribute for about 85% of those reports. To the family abductions, to abducted children. And I do want to talk about those classifications because it's very important when we're talking about children who are going missing that we keep those kinds of things in mind because this is sometimes what drives our media attention to this. But I also want to follow up is that we do applaud Commander Dickerson and her efforts to bring attention to all missing children. So we know that the conversation has gotten very spirited, but we think it's a good conversation to have because any attention that we can get to this issue of missing children, the better, because we need the public's help in getting these children back to safe places.
Speaking of Commander Dickerson, who commands D.C. Police's Youth and Family Division, she's new on the job. One of our colleagues at the WAMU newsroom asked her a question yesterday. She asked, why might these girls be missing?
The Amber Alert is the early public notification system where law enforcement agencies use to notify the public where we believe that a juvenile has been kidnapped and is in physical danger. So a lot of people were asking why we didn't issue out Amber Alerts in those cases. So I just wanted to put the criteria out there. We have no evidence that any of these missing teens have been kidnapped.
I mean, Bob, we'll get back to the question of why they might be missing in a second, but let's talk a little bit about the Amber Alert system and why it is so important. I know that sometimes I'll be sitting at work and my cell phone and Amber Alert will come up, and I always think, does this thing really help?
Oh, absolutely. I think Amber Alert has been a big game changer when it comes to finding critically missing children. Commander Dickerson is correct, and just by way of background, is that we do oversee the secondary Amber Alert system, which has been administered through the Department of Justice and is present in all 50 states. But it does have a few requirements, and it can become confusing. One is it has to involve the abduction of a child, and a child, of course, under the federal definition is a child under the age of 18. The second criteria is that the child's life has to be in physical danger, either of physical injury or death. And the third criteria, which becomes the more difficult one to understand, is there enough information that we can share through an Amber Alert with the public to aid in the recovery of that child and getting them back to a safe place? So there's actually three criteria that's required. And, of course, I think Commander Dickerson is correct. Not every child that's missing rises to the level of Amber Alert, but can during the episode of the missing, and I can get in more depth on the risk these children face.
We're talking about the phenomenon of missing teenagers with Julia Craven. She's a reporter for The Huffington Post, and with Robert Lowry Jr., Vice President of the Missing Children Division at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. We'd love to hear from you as well. If you've got stories or thoughts about missing teens, a teen that you know, a family that you know, email us at 1A@WAMU.org. You can also comment on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. We're at 1A. I want to talk a little bit to you both about some of the root causes. And let's go back to this clip of tape from Commander Chanel Dickerson. She works for D.C. Police's Youth and Family Division. One of our colleagues here asked her, why do you think these girls are going missing?
Well, there's always a concern for human trafficking. However, we have no reason to believe that human trafficking is connected to any of the recent cases. The majority of our missing person cases voluntarily leave home and they return or are located within a short period of time.
Robert, I got to be honest. I hear human trafficking and I'm never quite sure what that means. What is human trafficking?
Well, we refer to it as child sex trafficking.
Okay.
And these where the children are lured into a lifestyle by pimps and those who want to exploit them for paid sexual services with those who wish to have those services. And, of course, their lives become under the control of someone who obviously does not have the best interests of these children at heart. And it's a very dangerous circumstance, which is why at the National Center, we also focus very closely because of this issue on children missing from care, which is going to be the population of foster care children around the country. 2014, President Obama actually signed in a law called the Preventing Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act. And we asked to be a part of that law. And specifically, it now requires that social service agencies are mandated to report children missing from care, not only to law enforcement, but also to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And the reason we did that is that our experiences and anecdotally at the National Center is these children are, while they're all children are at risk, but these children are especially at risk for exploitation because of the fact that they've been placed under state guardianship. They don't have the same family support that other children have, even though it's not the entire population. We're seeing disproportionate numbers of kids and children missing from care, as we do in what we know to be a regular household.
Coming up, we'll look into how these issues are being addressed and what parents can do to keep their kids safe. We hope you'll share today's podcast with someone you know who will find it thought-provoking. And for one more week, we're asking you to spread the word about podcasts and the shows that are important to you, whether it's a podcast from NPR or somewhere else. On Twitter, @CHElver says, I love @NPREmbedded, @LongestShortest, and @538. All keep me sane during long walks with a newborn. Tell a friend about a podcast you think they'll love, then tell us what you recommend it. When you do, use the #tripod. That's #TRYPOD. And check out the hashtag on Twitter to see what others are saying.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from thinkaboutyoureyes.com. Some of the strongest muscles in your body are in your eyes. But did you know that your eyes can get strained from using digital devices? Constantly reading on your phone or tablet can cause stress to the muscles of your eyes. But your eye doctor can help you to combat eye strain. See an eye doctor yearly. Find one at thinkaboutyoureyes.com and keep those muscles feeling fit. Support also comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first 3 Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/1A.
This is 1A. I'm Noelle King of NPR's Planet Money podcast. I'm filling in for Joshua Johnson, and we're discussing missing children with Julia Craven, a reporter from the Huffington Post, and Robert Lowry of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Now, Julia, you have been in these communities talking to parents in Southwest DC where children are going missing. And one of the things that you brought up is a sense that there is a racial disparity. There are more Black and brown teens going missing than there are white teens. Is the fear that the police, law enforcement are not taking this as seriously because these kids are coming from communities of color? Or is there enough trust to say maybe the numbers are outsized because these kids are suffering at home?
So
it's a hard question.
It is a tough question. Black parents, Black people, Black and brown people, we know what we know. And the fact of the matter is that when you have a strained relationship with the police department, when you feel as though you can't trust the police to come in and even police your communities properly without inflicting unnecessary violence on someone, when there's such a deep distrust between these two groups of people, it boils over into other issues. So I would say the sense is that there's not really a whole lot of trust here for the police department. And that was evident at the town hall last night. Tensions flared up. The community had a lot of questions. And it kind of seemed like the government officials who were there they kind of had a tendency to speak on the availability of resources versus the accessibility and how it's not necessarily feasible for a working parent to check in with their child all of the time or monitor their kids on social media all of the time. So there seems to be this gap almost between the community and the police department. And one thing that I do just want to briefly loop back to when we were talking about Amber Alerts is that there is a racial disparity in Amber Alerts. We do not see Amber Alerts for Black and brown girls. So I just wanted to also make that known.
Bob Lowry of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, I want to get to two things with you about what Julia just said. The first thing is you are a former assistant police chief. You worked in the suburbs of St. Louis. Does mistrust among the police and the communities they serve, does it go some way toward making it less likely that these kids are going to be looked for in a serious way or that they won't be reported by their parents because of this mistrust? Did you see any of that when you were on the job as a cop?
Well, you know, I can say no. And I can tell you that when we took a report of a missing child, we treated them all, you know, as serious as the circumstances would allow. You know, obviously, you know, missing children go missing for a variety of reasons, and I'm just trying to give you an overview. But some kids are running away because they've had a problem in the home, maybe a bad report card, which would fall on the risk assessment model a little bit as a lower risk, as opposed to a child who, as I agree with, may have been lured away. So, you know, from my experiences on the police department, we would always look at the risk those children were facing, not only at the time that they went missing, but also during the duration of that. Because sometimes the fact that we characterize these children and we classify them, I think, maybe inappropriately as runaway children, is we need to look a little bit deeper and scratch the surface in which we advocated to why that child ran. Was there abuse in the home? Were they running away from a situation that was dangerous in that home? Were they being lured by someone? And, of course, not only maybe when they first left, the risk may have been low, but during the time in the duration of that missing, those risks changed. So at the National Center, one of the first things I did when I came up here was we removed that classification from our posters. And if you go on the National Center's website today, you no longer see endangered runaway or family abduction because we've dealt with a desensitized public. Because the first notion is that when you talk about a runaway child is the fact that there was a behavioral problem, and that and many times that's not the case at all.
And we so forget that. Yeah, we see runaway and we forget, well, if that kid is 12, 13, 14, that is still a kid that's out in the world, not with his or her family. That's a very interesting update and development. Go ahead.
But I also want to point out one last thing is we work with 17,000 to 18,000 law enforcement agencies each day. And I have to tell you that I can only speak from my own personal experiences and not for all 18,000 agencies who seem to every agency does seem to take the issue of missing children with a seriousness that they should. But I can't speak for all of them. And we work with each one of them each day. And each one of them seems to do things just slightly different. But going back to D.C., I do applaud Commander Dickerson because she's taking steps further than I've seen with other agencies, and we do hope that that becomes a trend.
I want to bring someone else into the conversation. Joining us now from Annapolis, Maryland, is Felicia Henry. She's director of operations at Courtney's House. That's an organization that supports young men and women who have been sex trafficked between the ages of 12 and 21. Felicia, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Felicia, you were at the town hall meeting in Washington last night, along with Julia, the reporter. You heard Mayor Muriel Bowser say, hear from families who are really concerned. Tell me what your takeaway was from that meeting. I watched some video of it online this morning. I mean, some of these parents seemed frantic.
Yes, I think the biggest takeaway from the meeting last night is there's still a lot of education that needs to happen within our communities to educate our parents and also our kids on what sex trafficking, what domestic sex trafficking really looks like. Because there's a lot of fear. I heard a lot about people saying, well, we need to walk our children home. And I want to be careful that we don't assume that trafficking is always this kidnapping situation, which that can be part of it. But we've got to remember that pimps and traffickers, they're going to go after our most vulnerable. So it is our chronic runaways, our children that are in foster care or that have very loose family ties, and also with mental health disabilities. And so my biggest takeaway is that there's a lot more education that needs to happen, and we're committed to ensuring that last night isn't just a one-time thing. And I think Councilmember White said that as well, that this was the first step to a conversation that we need to continue to have about how we can better allocate services to the community to support children who are trafficked.
Felicia, you work directly with some of these girls and boys who have been trafficked. And let me ask you, when a teen goes missing and we hear later that he or she was trafficked, what does that mean? How does that actually happen? Is this a friend that you know that forces you into prostitution? Is this I'm walking to the mall and someone, you know, puts me in the back of a van? What is the process?
So the first thing I want to say is that we've got to get away from blaming our children.
Mm.
You know, children are not leaving home because they got a few bad grades or because their mom gave them a curfew. They're being manipulated. And so when a child goes missing, those referrals come into us from the Metropolitan Police Department, the Youth Division. And I also want to say all officers, all detectives that work on this issue in MPD, they do great work. They work very closely with us. And so they can come from the Youth Division for MPD. They can come from Child and Family Services Agency, or they could come from probation officers, as well as social workers. So there's a number of entities that they can come from, but really what this means is that their guardian or their parent is unaware of their whereabouts. And so they would reach out to the police department to let them know that their child is missing. But another thing is that we should mention is that one of the biggest indicators with sex trafficked youth is that they do leave home multiple times. And so when we receive referrals, 9 times out of 10, this isn't the first time they left home. So that tells us immediately that it's not a very small thing, like I got into a dispute with my parent or I'm upset about something that took place at school. We know that there is a predator manipulating them to leave home, and we know that it's related to trafficking. The majority of those kids on the missing police reports released from MPD were referred to us or are currently in our program. So here at Courtney's House, we know that sex trafficking is behind these missing kids, and we also know that we can do a better job of allocating resources because we're getting 4 to 5 referrals per week on top of our caseload of 38 kids. So we're getting to a point where we've got to figure out how we can support organizations like Courtney's House, who's doing the work on the ground every day.
I want to play a message for the three of you that came into our inbox here at 1A. Have a listen.
My name is Lukman Ismi, and I've experienced this in a tragic way because the mother of my child was missing when my son was 7 months. My child is now 19 years old. Never been able to find her. Local police never been able to do anything. Family have never seen her. And it's kind of really depressing. And I don't think the local law enforcement care to do anything about it.
Bob, I'm going to come back to you in just a second. But first, Felicia, I want to ask you, because we have heard this from Julia, the sense that law enforcement doesn't care enough to do anything about it. You work with children, you work with teenagers. When you talk to them about who was there to help them, who rescued them, in fact, do you get the impression that these kids think law enforcement is my friend, law enforcement, the police, were there to help me?
That's a great question, because, and again, I just, you know, I think that there is a narrative that the police aren't doing anything, and I don't think that's necessarily true. You know, as I mentioned, MPD in particular, they have a youth division, and their primary role is to investigate sex trafficking crimes. And so we know for sure that they're trying their best with the resources that they have at their disposal to really tackle this issue. But I do believe that we have a lot of growth to do in terms of strengthening the trust between survivors and the police. This relationship is critically important, and this is what I mentioned last night, because at the end of the day, if we are not prosecuting cases,
if we are not starting to break down these networks, because it is organized crime, if we're not breaking down these human trafficking networks, then we're just going to be going around in circles. And so, for example, if a raid is done and a child is found in that raid, sometimes those detectives are the primary individual that's able to talk with that survivor. And so if there is distrust, if that survivor does feel like she's being judged or she doesn't feel comfortable sharing her story, then the ability to gather information to then pass that on to state's attorneys, if that doesn't happen, then the entire process of us convicting and prosecuting is undermined. So we've got to strengthen that relationship, and I think the best way we can do that is through training. Police officers, there is some training that we do with police, so we can give them tactics and tools that they can use while they're with a survivor. Because the nature of this particular trauma, of course, you're immediately distrustful of the police. But we do know that this isn't the end game. You know, one of the things that we do with our detectives, we invite them over to our drop-in center. We invite them over to events that we have throughout the year. And what that does is it exposes the survivors to the detectives. So that way, if anything comes about or arises, if they have any open cases, that survivor will feel comfortable with sharing with that detective.
Bob, I want to turn this over to you for a second. We have now had our other two panelists who were both at a press conference or a community meeting that was held here in D.C. say that they heard a lot about suspicion of the police. We had a gentleman call in and say, I feel like law enforcement didn't do much. I think what might be happening here is that we're seeing this through two different lenses. And Bob, I wonder if we were to just accept that there's a feeling there of mistrust. As a former police officer who now works with an organization that seeks to find and support missing children, what do you think we need to do in terms of bridge building here?
Well, I'm going to go back to a couple of points. And one is, I agree 100% with what Felicia said. We have a tendency to blame children in these cases. Parents, I think, rightfully are concerned. I think they vicariously place themselves in the shoes of those families who have a child who's lost or missing or been runaway. And this frightens all of us down to our absolute core. But I think there are a lot of issues here that that probably need to be discussed. One is one on trafficking. We're still getting a better understanding of that issue. We know it's that issue exists, and it's troubling, and I think significant. Although when we ask you if these children are identifying themselves or view police as their friends, and they're not. Many times these children don't even acknowledge themselves as victims of this, and they are. They are victims, and this is a thing that I think law enforcement has become a better understanding on when they are dealing with these children, that they are victims. But law enforcement alone isn't going to solve the issue of missing children and trafficking, because it's so important to point out, and that organizations like Courtney House is so important to this process, that these children need to be introduced into services so we can get them back into a stable environment and to where they don't believe that trafficking is the only likely outcome for them, is for them to survive, that there are other outcomes. So we stand firmly with Felicia and her organization and many others like that are going to make the difference in the lives of these children. So I think it's important that we can't always rely that the police are going to be the sole ones that can do that, because I can tell you, we can find these kids. Keeping them out of that circumstance is the dilemma, because I can tell you in my own personal experience, I had two group homes on the patrol beat that I rode, and we would not only take multiple reports from those group homes, but the moment we found them, brought them back, the children would walk right out the door. And there is no, and I think this best explained is those group homes are not jail. They're not detention centers. They're supposed to be the home that those children are supposed to be lived with. So they have no, they can't be physically restrained to be kept there. So we have to incentivize those kids in other ways to make sure that they stay in safe environments and they understand when they're safe. Now, to your caller's point, he's describing what I believe would be a family abduction scenario, where one parent takes the child and denies contact with the other parent. We work those cases every day at the National Center. In fact, we have specialized teams that do nothing but family abduction as a scenario.
Yeah, and now, I imagine that when we're talking about criminal cases, it must actually be a very different scenario. But this question of kids not identifying as victims really speaks to the work that Felicia Henry is doing, because that just must be an enormous task. Felicia, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Felicia is Director of Operations at Courtney House. It supports youth who have been sex trafficked. Thank you, Felicia.
Thank you.
Julia, I know that you have been writing a lot about social media and the role that social media is playing in both getting the word out that these kids are missing and sometimes in finding them. Can you talk a little bit about the reporting that you've done around social media?
Yes. So social media is definitely bringing more attention to the fact that the girls are missing. And in some cases, it can increase the visibility of the missing teen to the point where their peers can jump in and be like, hey, I actually know where this person is. Here's some information. It can alert the community. So that way, if you're walking down the street or if you just happen to be somewhere and you see this person, you see this teenager, you can identify them. You can call the police. You can send some type of update. But social media has also become a breeding ground for people who are trying to lure teens away and traffic them. So there's a flip side to that. A lot of people, you know, they post these advertisements on social media. They talk to teenagers through Facebook and stuff. And that can be a mechanism to lure them away from home. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword.
So much with social media is, isn't it? We've actually had some questions this hour coming in from listeners, and I want to put a couple of those to you, too. We have a question for you, Bob Lowry. A listener asks us, are LGBTQ youth at greater risk for running away?
I would say yes. I think the social pressures on those children are probably greater than, say, a child from that lifestyle. And we do accept those reports at the National Center. We work with families and law enforcement to get those children back to a safer place. So, in answer to your question, yes, we do have concerns for the safety of those kids.
Are there any special initiatives for those type of youth in terms of, well, I imagine that probably wouldn't happen at the police level, but within schools, within communities, do you think it's important to have the kind of support for those kids individually or as a group?
Well, I think the support, yes, I think it needs to come from the community in terms of the schools and other organizations. Now, obviously, our focus is, like any child who is missing, is to focus on locating that child and getting them back to a safe place. The counseling parts of these is why it's so important that the community provides support in these cases, like Courtney House, and I'm sure there are other services out there for our other vulnerable populations of youth. And I would certainly put the LGBT community into that vulnerability category as especially vulnerable to those who will exploit them.
Bob, we got another interesting tweet with respect to law enforcement. It came in from Eric, and he asks, does an Amber Alert or a missing child report automatically trigger a Child Protective Services inquiry? I would imagine what he's asking is, if you report a child missing, is your family going to be investigated?
No, and it does not. What it does, though, is the circumstances why that child's missing or been abducted would drive that more so than the Amber Alert itself. So the fact that the Amber Alert's out there is to protect the child, get them located and as quickly as we can. And I have to tell you, it's probably been the number one most successful program that we have to engage the public when critically missing children are. I think there have been nearly 900 children since the inception of Amber Alert have actually been rescued and returned to their families.
Wow.
As a result, when years ago, it may have been a different outcome.
Julia, I know you have thoughts on Amber Alert as well.
Yes. Just to answer that that tweet that came in, MPD is a department where if a child is when a child is found and returned home, if necessary, they will get social services involved and other child protective services to figure out why the child ran away from home in the first place.
That's
so
here.
I just wanted to throw that in there.
Here in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
That's good to know. We got an email in from Randy, and I'm going to ask both of you guys this question because I really like it. Randy says, a missing child is a tragedy no matter what their race. I'm sure we all agree on that. Randy says, I'm white, but I'll be the first to acknowledge that I'm sure there is a subconscious racial bias, as your guest has suggested. I'm sure that some do this consciously, but if it's subconscious, what do you recommend we do to make ourselves more conscious about this racial disparity? Julia, let me start with you.
That is a great question.
Yeah.
And the main thing that we can do is we have to better train police officers. There has to be implicit bias training. That should be mandatory across departments, because it will fix an entire host of issues. It will fix how we handle missing persons cases. It will fix how police interact with certain communities just in general. So implicit bias training, we need that. It's very important. We all have them.
Implicit bias training, Bob, maybe this is a better question for you. What does implicit bias training look like? I mean, explicit bias training seems pretty easy. How do we talk to officers about, maybe preconceived notions they have about certain communities?
Well, I think it's a good question. And I think it's also a difficult one to answer, because implicit bias obviously is not always as easily to detect or see, but it's all the biases that any one person can have. I would have to say, and I'm going to take what Julia said just maybe a little step further, is that, we work cases all across the United States, and we've seen disparities on the amounts of media coverage that are given to children. I know that it was brought up many times, and I think is one of the very visible signals of that was when we saw Natalie Holloway go missing down when she was on vacationing. And then, of course, that was compared very often to Felicia Barnes over in Baltimore. And we had worked with both families in that case and law enforcement to try to find those children. Both have been found, Felicia has been found. But the point is that even the Baltimore police pointed out the fact that they were not able to get enough media coverage on that particular case like we saw with Natalie. And sometimes I point back and I ask our friends from media that's a good question for the media also. On why that is, because when it comes to missing children, we all need to be colorblind. A missing child is a missing child, and they face dangers, and we have to address them in the same way. And this is what we try to espouse at the National Center, is colorblindness. In fact, that we need to find these kids and get them rescued as quickly as possible. And why that happens, I have no idea.
I must say, I wasn't aware, but I am extremely impressed to hear that the Baltimore Police Department themselves drew attention to the fact that there was a racial disparity. That is, I think, surprising and heartening. Julia, want to jump in?
Absolutely. I agree with Bob that the media does need to be better about these things. And a lack of media coverage, because it's called missing white woman syndrome, right?
Yes, that's a term for it. Yeah.
So whenever Natalie Holloway, the Elizabeth Smarts, the Kaylee Anthonys of the world go missing, it's looped. It's on cable news. It's something that we know about. These girls are household names. You don't even have to Google them if you're a certain age. But when the Relisha Rudds of the world go missing, the Felicia Barnes of the world, we don't talk about it. And a lot of that is a lack of value associated with black and brown women. And it's something that we have to work on in our newsrooms. And
I would also agree with what Julia is saying, too. Relisha Rudd is a child, of course, at 8 years old. And if you see those images of this child, it touches all of our hearts. And the amount of work that was done and efforts that went into locating this child were like we've never seen across the country. In fact, we assisted the D.C. Metro PD on several occasions on helping locate Relisha. It's been a very, very frustrating process. And I can tell you that an extreme amount of effort has gone into that. Into those search and that investigation. And sadly, the offender in this particular case took that to his grave. But I do want to point out is that at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, Relisha's case will never be closed until that child has been physically found. And that pertains to all of our missing children across the country.
We have a question here from a listener that I think feeds very nicely into what you've both been saying, and it is a very direct question. He says, this is a Facebook comment from Peter. He says, please discuss what people should do if they need to find a missing person. Police? Media? Social media? What? What do you think? Bob, let's start with you.
All of the above.
All of the above.
The most powerful tool that we have when a child goes missing is our ability to engage the public real time when that child's missing. We ask the public, for one, to please pay attention to the child's face and facial features. If you see someone that looks like that child, do not hesitate. In fact, it's on our posters. Call 911. Report it. And I tell you, as a former police officer, I would rather respond to 100 reports that led us to a dead end and to overlook that possibility just because someone was reluctant and didn't report it, that we might be able to rescue a child. social media, and I'll follow up a little bit what Julia said, has become the most powerful tool that we have in our arsenal now. We can reach millions of people, and we can even target those images of those children to specific geographic areas. So it's become a tremendous tool. I agree that it has a downside as well, but it's also a tremendously powerful tool in our media. And in the and I do stress very strongly that we need more support from our media when it comes to our missing kids to get the word out. And sometimes our missing children can get drowned out and with other big stories that go on, and certainly understandable, but it's also important to know that that child's life could be in danger, and we need the public's help and get them back.
Julia, there was an interesting part of your piece on this story about a Twitter user who appears to be the person, I believe her handle is at Black Marvel Girl. Mm-hmm. She's the person who seems to have drawn immediate and intense attention to these disappearances in D.C. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Yeah, she tweeted it out and she was like, it takes like 8 seconds to retweet this and get this information out there and help find these girls. And she's right. I think it's amazing that MPD wants to put these cases on social media. I think that they could be better about updating when these kids have been found. I also think that their website could be better, just from a reporting standpoint, especially. And that was also something that came up at the town hall last night. People were just like, you have to better update when these kids have been found. You have to keep your website updated as well, because sometimes the two can conflict one another.
MPD is Metropolitan,
Metropolitan Police Department.
Here in DC.
That is DC's police department.
Okay.
Sorry. And another thing that came up at the town hall last night that I think fits mm-hmm. into this current discussion that we're having is one woman who went up to the mic to speak about her experiences with her brother being missing, if I'm not mistaken. She said that the media doesn't come to you and that the community has to work harder to get these issues publicized. And I understand where she was coming from, but at the same time, I feel like the media could be a lot more receptive to these issues. And we also have to understand why people in certain communities do not come to us for things, because they don't trust us to cover it properly.
I want to close out the hour with some tips and with some optimistic news. Bob, you mentioned very early, Julia's smiling, I guess. We got to try, right? Bob, you mentioned very early on that the numbers of missing children have actually been going down over the past couple of years. What's happened?
They have.
What's
and
going on?
It's a very good question. Is that in the early, late 90s, we were looking at about 800,000 NCIC reports of missing children across the country annually. Today, that number's dropped nearly 460,000 reports. And I attribute a lot of that to technology. The fact is that children are found faster today than ever before because we have an engaged public. We have an engaged law enforcement that knows the seriousness of the issue of missing children. But also the fact that our parents can locate their children either through social media or through a cell phone that many of our children carry. It can sometimes be a very important thing when you're looking for your child. Maybe they're late coming home. Maybe there's some other circumstances than the parent can get directly involved before having to get to law enforcement. So also I want to point out that the numbers of abducted children, those stereotypical abductions of children, we're seeing dramatic decreases in those. And these are the children maybe going to and from school who have been grabbed off the street corner and taken by an offender. But while I say that, I think the fact that we have cameras on almost every street corner today, the fact that we're all with our smartphones carrying cameras with us, these offenders don't want to be seen. So we haven't discouraged them only from taking them physically, but I go back to that social media has been a platform for many of these, and I couldn't agree more with Julia on that. The sad reality is that these offenders now, instead of street corner abductions of children, are now relying on social media to lure and groom our kids. And we got to keep in mind is that law enforcement sometimes will improperly view that child as a runaway because she voluntarily went with an offender. And I'm saying that danger that child is in is extremely high as it would be with that physical abduction. So we're doing our part. We're educating law enforcement on the importance of paying closer attention to these luring cases, even though that child went voluntarily. That child had been groomed, and that child's a victim, and we need to get that child back to a safe place quickly.
Bob, how about some news you can use as we come to the end of the hour? I saw the most fascinating tip in a news article the other day. It said As a parent, you should friend your child on Facebook, but you should not let them know that it's mom or dad. This is so that you can watch them. And I thought, well, gosh, that's going to be controversial among your average group of 16-year-olds. But I mean, how should parents be looking out for their children beyond just let me know where you're going to be? Are there specific tips for parents who I'm sure are very worried after hearing this hour?
Well, you know, in social media is a bunch of a blessing. It is a curse. And we do encourage parents to be very cognizant of their child's activity with social media. But that's a pretty difficult task because these social media sites are coming and going as quickly as you can imagine. Not every one of these children are going to be on Facebook. In fact, many of them are going to be on social media like Kick and some of the other sites that seem to be very popular with children now, and they're changing every day. Like we're even finding cases where children are encrypting messages because they don't want their parents to know what's going on. But again, I think frank conversations with our children is very important to have. Spying, you know, I think builds distrust, but I think being cognizant of it is a good, healthy thing to do, and having frank conversations about the dangers these children face. Keep in mind, these are children, and they can be very naive, and they can be easily taken into the clutches of someone wanting to do them harm without even realizing what happened.
That's it for today's podcast. Earlier on the broadcast, we talked about how gentrification is pricing people out of cities and into suburbs. You can hear that and every segment of every show on our website, the1a.org. We hope you'll share this episode with someone and keep the conversation going. Remember to rate and review this podcast so more listeners can find it. You can always reach us on our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter @1a, or email us 1a@wamu.org. I'm Noelle King. Thanks for listening.